Well, how do these cultists round up people, their followers? Let's check in with Peter Lavenda when we come right back with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Peter Lavenda with us. Peter's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You can get all his works there. And also, I assume you're on Amazon.com as well, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. Amazon and Barnes & Noble for sure.
Super. Excellent. Now, how do these cultists get their followers to follow them?
Well, it's like I say, it's the Manson secret, you know. Sargent wrote about it, this man that I mentioned before, who was really prominent in the MKUltra type of studies that he did. And he said that what you first do is you induce some degree of nervous tension or stir up sufficient feelings of anger or anxiety.
Or fear.
Your undivided attention. And then you increase their suggestibility this way. You prolong stress. So what you're doing is you're creating a state of nervous stress, of nervous anxiety. And so what the cults do is they look for people who are disaffected, they're dissatisfied, they feel weakened, they feel vulnerable, and they focus on them and kind of increase that a little bit and then bring them in, implant the ideas at that point. Get somebody wound up, as we used to say in the Bronx, wind them up. And then when they're really nervous and they're angry and they're dissatisfied and they want to lash out at someone, that's when you get them. You bring them in, you give them the potential to go out and to do something about their anger. And it's really, it's behavior modification, basically. But it's what's done. I mean, the secret societies used to do similar things to create initiations. They would blindfold you. They would bring you in on the point of a sword. They would create all sorts of stressful situations. They would make you think you're on the verge of being killed. And in that moment, something would happen to you psychologically. At that moment, you surrendered, basically, to the cult or to the secret society. And at that point, you attained the first preliminary stage of initiation. And there were deeper stages and deeper stages. And these people understood how to manipulate consciousness and how to go into, you know, the unconscious mind and kind of rearrange its contents a little bit. These are people who understood how to do that. It's a technique that's been passed down for thousands of years. And, you know, the Nazis brought it up to one level of competence, and then other groups have done the same thing. And you have it right now with the Islamic State doing much of that itself. The Islamic State is basically just a cult. I mean, it's nothing more than a cult. And it's a cult of violence, and it's a cult that's using the same stuff that they learned from their trainers going back in the day. I wrote a book called The Hitler Legacy, showing how Nazis after the war had escaped to North Africa and the Middle East, as an example, mm-hmm. and then used their technologies to train the Palestinians, liberation organization people, to train other types of commandos in North Africa against the French in Algeria and in Morocco. So these were, you know, some of the same technologies, some of the same methods were being used and trained in, you know, new recruits, new types of people, new blood, as it were, to go out there and to do the same thing. These were techniques that were learned by the Germans, you know, during the war, and then they would train people in Latin America the same way, in Chile and Argentina and Brazil. They would use the same techniques, the same technologies. What you can use to torture someone, to get information out of them, some of the same techniques in modified form is used to create really devoted followers. You use the same ideas of the stress application and the idea that you may be going into a very dangerous situation, you could die because of what's going on, and then you gradually pull the person out as their savior, and then that person becomes a devoted follower.
Even though those people from Heaven's Gate that all killed themselves.
Yes.
Thinking there was a UFO hiding behind a comet and stuff. During 9/11, do you remember that terror color scheme that they would always come out with? You know,
oh, yeah. Right.
Condition, you know, yellow, condition red. I thought that was manipulative and horrible, and I'm glad they finally stopped doing it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was very ill-advised. It was just kind of stupid. And we all knew it was stupid because we all made fun of it at the time. So it really didn't work the way they intended it to, because we greeted it with some degree of, you know, suspicion. But yeah, I agree. I mean, when you start employing color codes and symbol sets to manipulate behavior that way, It's a little too much 1984, you know.
It really is. It really is. Let's take some calls here for you, Peter, as they begin to line up. We go to Danny in Belmont, California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Danny. Go ahead. Danny, you with us?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Danny. Well, we're going to let Danny go, unfortunately. We could hear him. He could not hear us. Let's try Todd in Minnesota. Nope, Todd's not ready either. Let's go to Joe in Long Island, New York. Maybe we'll luck out here. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, Peter, George.
Hi.
Yeah, as far as the movie Eyes Wide Shut and a template for that, you know, the origin of that, you know, depicting a secret society. So that would be one question. The second would be Hitler's speeches and the emotion-driven part of it. And did he escape to Argentina? And the third question would be just the seeming cultish activities around Bill and Hillary Clinton that have been rumored.
Okay, right. That's quite a mouthful there to start with. Let me start from the beginning. You were talking about Eyes Wide Shut, of course, the Stanley Kubrick film. Yeah, I mean, it for a lot of people saw a lot in that film depicting, you know, real secret societies mm-hmm. and how they operate.
And you have to watch it several times, Peter, to get it.
Yeah, you do. You have to get past the sort of the shock value the first time,
yeah,
and then sort of look at it more critically the second and third time. And you can see that there was a lot there. Kubrick was definitely one of those directors who knew what he was talking about. I mean, he put a lot of stuff in his films that really require you to go back and rewatch them several times to get, you know, more meaning out of it. So I don't think we have time really to go into the whole Eyes Wide Shut mythology. I think the second question was Hitler and
Hitler and his speeches, which were electrifying. Yeah. It was a good speech.
Well, they were, even if you didn't speak the language. I mean, there's reports of people who didn't speak German who happened to have been present during some of these speeches and rallies, and they were moved, and they just didn't know why. And that's what Hitler wanted to do. He wanted to go straight there. I mean, there's a power in repetition and chanting. I mean, look at the Catholic Church. I mean, the power they had when they were doing everything in Latin, which most people didn't understand what they were saying, but they had a sort of mysticism and a power and a strength. Hitler, doing his speeches, was doing the same thing. Some of his speeches were sort of incomprehensible if you actually wrote it down and tried to figure out what he was saying.
Yeah, they were just all shouting.
He was doing it as a ritual incantation, basically.
Do you think fear played a factor there, too, that all these people were just scared? They could just see what was happening, and they panicked?
Well, I mean, he manipulated fear to a great extent. I mean, it takes us back to Charles Manson again. Manson wrote an article, I think, for the Process Church called Fear, and he used to say to his followers, get the fear. You know, if you get the fear, if you can get fear and conquer fear, then you're able to do anything. And I think that the fear that the people in Germany had, they were frightened at the end of World War One. Their entire world had fallen apart. Their country was being carved into pieces, et cetera, et cetera. And here was Hitler coming along saying, yeah, you're right. You have a right to be afraid, a right to be anxious and desperate, and this is what we're going to do about it, you know. And his platform was very thin, but it was very emotionally resonant, and people just loved it, and they went along with it. And he put himself up as the savior who was going to fix the whole thing.
Let's go to Jack in Carpinteria, California, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Jack. Go ahead. Hello, Jack. Boy, we must be having some phone problems these days, huh? Tommy, check out these lines, if you would. Joe in the Bronx. We'll try you, Joe.
Hey, George. Happy New Year.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. Peter, yes, I wanted to ask you, how important in these cult figures like Manson or Hitler is the personal charisma that they employ, and also the drugs manipulation that Manson used as a technique of his, the nightshades, belladonna, etc., in getting his followers to do his bidding?
Sure. Thanks, Joe. Always good to talk to somebody from the Bronx, my native land. Yeah, as far as the manipulation, the charismatic figure and the importance of the charismatic figure, that's very important. I mean, that's the ball game. If you lack charisma, then you've got to really use a lot of other tools in order to get the same type of following, which leads us to the drugs. The drugs, what drugs are useful for in that context was because it was a fast track to the unconscious mind, to that material. It duplicated sort of the initiation experience and going through the obstacles and going through the darkness and through the gate and coming out the other side. The drugs simulated that in a very short period of time. The problem is quite often the effects were also very short-lived. They were not permanent. So drugs could be used to get people to a certain point where they were more susceptible to your message or to a charismatic leader. So they would reduce your inhibitions and allow you, you know, to be sort of open and vulnerable to a charismatic leader and their message, or to the cult in general and its message. I mean, our word for assassin, as I'm sure you know, comes from hashishin, right? These were people who took hashish, had their, you know, their visions of paradise based on this. They had a charismatic leader who gave them the hashish and then duplicated or simulated a kind of paradise experience. And when they came down from the drug, they had that memory that at some point they had actually seen paradise. So they were willing to go out and do the bidding of their charismatic leader, whatever that leader told them to do, at the risk of their own life. It no longer mattered anymore. So the drug and charismatic leader combination is very powerful. In Hitler's Germany, of course, that wasn't, you know, employed on such a wide scale, although it was employed among the troops to a certain extent. But as far as the ritual itself, that was pure ritual. I mean, the SS rituals were pure rituals, and they were conducted all around the world, torch-lit processions and the chanting and all the rest of it. There was a heavy, heavy occult ritual behind the SS, and the SS were the elite. The SS were the ones who did not give up at the end of World War II, who maintained their presence, maintained their operations as much as they could all around the world. These were the true believers. They had passed through that process. They had come out the other side as true believers, as initiates of this cult.
Are there any leaders there now, Peter, that are out there that you would say fits this category?
Well, it's as far as the pure Nazi category, most of them have died out, thankfully. The cult that I knew in Chile, of course, they still exist. They've had their teeth pulled, basically, and they're no longer the kind of threat they used to be. At least I don't believe they are. But there are still leaders in all of these countries who inherited the mantle of the SS initiators, you might say. They're SS leaders, they're role models who were in those countries. And they have groomed new leaders to take over from them. So this is still happening. You're seeing a great resurgence of neo-Nazism in Europe and in all over the world. I mean, you're seeing a resurgence of it even in places like Southeast Asia. And in parts of Africa and the Middle East, you're seeing a resurgence of this ideology. So we're going to see some very scary people come out of that.
Let's go to Minneapolis. Pat's with us, east of the Rockies. Pat, go ahead.
Quickly, I'll say that, like Yiddish, Latin can be used as a language worldwide that people who don't have another common language, but better yet, that others around them aren't understanding. But my most important thing has to do with fake news. Fake news. I told one of my sisters and one of my best friends, be very, very careful, because the wrongdoers themselves may plant fake news about themselves.
That's right.
Because yes, then they can say, oh, well, maybe there never was a plane with the name Lolita on it. I'll bet it's been painted over by now. But see, if they plant preposterous things against themselves that are... And then you find out there really aren't caves under the pizza place in Washington, D.C. Then they can say, see the fake news? Now that means all the rest of it is fake. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. You set it up that way.
I would even say to homicide detectives, anybody, any crackpot who is confessing to crimes they didn't commit, be sure to take their DNA, because they may be a very clever criminal or even a murderer who throws the authorities off by seeming like a crackpot by confessing to everything. And then if their DNA is in the, what do you call it, the databases, you may find out that some of those crackpots are really killers.
Interesting, Pat. Interesting take. What do you think of that, Peter?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point of view, and I think it's something that, you know, has a lot of merit behind it.
So with the novel that you wanted to weave some real-life stories into, what's the reaction been to it?
The reaction's been pretty good, I'm happy to say. There's, like I say, most of the novel is really based on fact. There's, I've mentioned a lot of different cults.
It's almost more nonfiction.
It's a lot of nonfiction, but strung along in a narrative. So there's a storyline, but the cults that I mentioned, with one, of course, major exception, the Lovecraft cult itself. All of the other cults that I mentioned, all the other religious denominations that I mentioned, they're all genuine. They all exist to this day. Some of them are thousands of years old. And it's the thing that we normally in the West don't realize about that part of the world. We think it's kind of monolithic. You know, it's all Muslims. You know, we kind of know there's Sunni and Shia, but past that, we don't know very much. But there's just a lot of different groups out there, and they're usually at each other's throats for one reason or another. But they are not; they don't share the same belief systems. And in fact, you know, in some cases, they're persecuted, like the Yazidi, as an example.
In Iraq,
they're
yeah.
like a major part of the novel. And, you know, the Yazidi were considered to be devil worshippers by almost everybody, by the Muslims for sure, and also by local Christians and Jewish groups. They all thought these people worshipped
the devil. But they weren't, were they?
No, not really, no. It's a misunderstanding of their theology that says they're devil worshippers. They don't worship the devil. They do acknowledge Satan, Shaitan, as they call him, as the first fallen angel. But they believe that God, in his mercy, is going to let Satan come back into heaven first at the end of days. And the Yazidi, who claim that they're as ancient almost as the most ancient of humans, that they'll be the first ones to enter heaven behind Satan when Satan is redeemed by God. So they have this kind of belief system, and it's a little bizarre to everyone else in the Middle East, but they can't be accused of actually worshiping the devil for that reason. It was misunderstanding. But the Islamic State almost destroyed the entire Yazidi population back in 2014 and 2015. There's been an ongoing genocide against them.
Oh, yeah, it's been horrible.
And their women and children have been taken into slavery and all the rest of it. So it's a hideous situation. And it's also, on another level, it's very interesting because it's the first time in modern times people are actually talking about the Yazidi. You know, this was a very arcane subject until just recently. No one knew these people existed. And they claim to be remnants of ancient Sumer. They claim that they're the descendants of the people who built the towers of Babylon and the ziggurats and all the rest of it. They claim that. There's cuneiform inscriptions on their coat of arms. So they really do believe that they are the descendants of ancient Sumer, which would make them descendants of the oldest civilization, you know, in the world. So that's their belief system. And they're in danger of being wiped out. You know,
all right, Peter, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with final comments and phone calls next. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Peter Lavenda with us. We'll get to your calls as well as we talk about, well, really all his works. The latest is The Lovecraft Code. These cultists, Peter, what about the individual who has been mind-controlled? Are they spiritual people? Are they weak people? What allows them to get drawn in?
Well, it cuts across all different levels of society, all different kinds of occupations. Right now, it's attracting a great many people. If we're talking about, for instance, the Islamic State as an idea of a cult, it's attracting a lot of young people who are otherwise unemployed. They have no future. They have no hope. So you're talking about people who maybe they feel discriminated against or whatever it might be. They feel they're fish out of water. They're living in an environment which is not, you know, conducive to whoever they feel that they are. So you have really, in a nutshell, you have the same thing that you had in Germany, to go back to that context again. The Germans in general felt this way. They felt isolated. They felt they had been betrayed by their own people. They felt that they were, you know, on the verge of collapse. There was nowhere for them to go. And Hitler came and gave them basically a home in his own cult. And that happens to anyone. You don't have to be particularly vulnerable intellectually or something. You can be very smart. You can be very accomplished in many areas of your life and still feel spiritually that you're missing something, that there's something that's just not there. You mm-hmm. feel a sense of hopelessness or a sense of vulnerability, anxiety, of fear. And these are the emotions that lead people into cults. I mean, happy, well-adjusted people rarely will join a cult. You know, there's just basically nothing in it for them. There's no attraction there. They're not looking for a home. They're not looking for a family or a father or a mother figure. So you're looking at people who are spiritually already a little weak. They may not look that way to the rest of us. They may look, prosperous and happy and healthy in many ways. But spiritually, they may be very weak. They're missing something. There's a moral compass that's spinning a little bit out of control. And it just takes someone else to come in who understands that to manipulate it. And the people who understand that and manipulate it, these are people who can be very evil by nature because they are looking for these vulnerabilities to exploit them. So, you know, the evil forces are operating through these people, people like the Hitlers of the world, who spot these individuals and who exploit them so shamelessly.
Even though he preached goodness, was Jesus a cultist? And were the followers in a cult?
Well, the thing is that the followers were in the same kind of state, right? They were in their homeland, but the homeland was being run by the Romans. So they were basically an occupied people. So you had a lot of the same sociological factors were at play in Israel at the time, as you had in other countries where the same thing has happened. So you have people who are disaffected and who felt vulnerable. And I think Jesus came along and offered them a way out. But his way out, as far as we know, as far as the historical Jesus is concerned, his way out was a purely spiritual one. He was not telling his people to raise up arms and to fight and to kill the oppressors. He said just the opposite, basically. So you could say it was a cult. The Jews at the time considered it a cult. You know, they considered mm-hmm. it was not mainstream Judaism. What he was preaching and what he was practicing was something quite different. So they were forced underground for a long time, the Christians, as we know. So, there are similarities there for sure. But the way it was employed, the way Jesus employed these ideas, was in a much more pacific, peaceful way, non-combative way.
All right, now to the phones again we go. Thomas is in La Jolla, California. Hello, Thomas.
Happy New Year, George.
Thank you, sir.
You and to your staff. And Peter Lavenda, I look forward to your book, The Lovecraft Code. I've enjoyed your writings. My question for you, Peter, is I want to use the Star Wars movies as a metaphor. You have the Force, okay, and then you have the Jedi and you have the Sith, which are the dark side of the Force. And from the outside, you know, people look at the idea of the Force as an ancient religion, you know, has no meaning. You know, it's ritualistic, etc. But from the inside, if you're a Jedi initiate, you realize that the Force is real. If you're a Sith initiate, you realize that the Force is real. It's an actual technology, if you will, a technology of magic. My question is, it seems, okay, speculation on my part, but it seems to me that World War II was at root a battle of magic technologies. You have the SS, okay, practicing ritual. You look at it from the outside and you say, oh, that's conditioning. But from the inside, it could be an application of magic to influence reality, reality creation, if you will. And then you have like Winston Churchill, who had a military advisor who not only advised him on military affairs, but was a practicing magician. And it was rumored that he had organized covens of witches and warlocks to cast spells on Germany. So you have this sort of this working technology of magic, of reality creation. From the outside, it looks like conditioning. It looks like, oh, this is ritual. But from the inside, it may be a reality manipulation, deliberate intent, if you will. And I'm wondering if World War II was really a conflict between two magical worldviews, one Anglo-American secret societies, and on the German side, you have the Nazi SS and their view of the universe. And that's my question for you, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about this in perhaps a slightly different language. I didn't use the Star Wars metaphors, but basically the same thing. You know, religion is one thing, but mysticism and magic is the technology. You know, it is a technology. I consider it that way. I consider it a technology of spirituality, let's say. It's method, and that method is, as I pointed out, where initiations are concerned, those methods haven't changed very much over thousands of years because it is a viable technology. When people go to church on Sunday, it's one thing. That's the group manifestation of this. But on a deeper level, the people who actually create religions and they build up the rituals and they're the ones credited with developing all of these techniques, this is more similar to magic than it is to religion, even more similar to mysticism than it is to religion. These are technologies of spirituality. And it's always struck me that the mystics of any religion always get along with each other very well. The theologians don't, you know. The clergy of various religions hate each other, or despise each other, or call each other names and say this one is false and this one isn't. But the mystics of any religious discipline will always get along with the other mystics. So you'll have, you know, Kabbalists, Jewish Kabbalists getting along very well with Tibetan Buddhist mystics, for instance. They'll exchange information. They'll understand each other innately because they're talking about the technology and how what they've achieved with it. Whereas the formal religious leaders do not get along. Of course, they're protecting a social organization that has the truth, quote-unquote, compared to everyone else. So, you know, my shorthand answer is, yes, I could see that it would look that way. It would look like a battle between two different types of occult concepts, occult beliefs, of two different kinds of technologies, basically, or the same technology, but in different hands, being employed in a different way. That's been kind of the point of view of modern Western esotericism anyway, that whether you're a quote-unquote black magician or a quote-unquote white magician, you're basically using the same technique and the same magic. It's just the ends to which you put it and your understanding of what it is will be different depending upon which side that you're on.
And Peter, with all that's been going on in this planet right now, is there some behind-the-scenes manipulation going on to do this, to develop cults? Are there some power brokers doing this? I would think they might be.
Well, yeah, I think there might be, and I think that you know, we're seeing people who are involved in the sciences now actually getting very close to this type of material, these types of technologies. There's a bleed over between what you might have considered pure occultism or pure magic even 50 or 100 years ago, and today what's being done in some of the consciousness studies stuff that I've been studying. There's a lot of crossover here. People are taking it now very seriously. There's some very sober academic work coming out, especially out of Europe, but also out of the United States, where magic is concerned, the modern ceremonial Western occult practices, and interpreting them, you know, in light of what we now know about consciousness studies. So you can see that there's this tendency now to say, maybe we can do what CIA tried to do with MKUltra back 50 years ago. Maybe we can do this now. Maybe we understand it better. And maybe we can employ some of these technologies. There's a lot of research being done on drugs right now, too, hallucinogens. There's a lot of work being done now. It's become more academically accepted to talk about these things. I mean, 50 years ago, you couldn't talk about the Kabbalah in an academic setting, but you can now.
You can now.
Legitimate, yeah. You know, in terms of regular academia. So it's happening. You know, these things are happening. The ideas are being promoted on the surface, which means to me that under the surface, as you implied, that there's a much greater study and research that's taking place, and that people are trying to use some of these technologies to manipulate reality, to manipulate what we think of as what is really going on in the world, you know, manipulating the message. Everything from television commercials, for instance, to the actual news itself, sometimes we're having a hard time telling the difference. And it's getting more and more like that. It's getting more and more a question of entertainment. We're following in what Hitler suggested, which is go right to the emotions of the people without bothering their intellect. And it's funny because we have access to social media like never before. We have access to the internet like never before, and yet we seem to be learning less and less. And that may be deliberate.
Well, of course it is, I think. There's no doubt. Let's go to Linda in Windsor, Canada. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. I wish I'd known you when I tell you my story, because I've listened to you, and the reason I found out about you is on this show and years ago. And everything you've said in the spiritual arena is so right on, and we lack so much knowledge in that area, and it's being kept from us from learning it. But I'll tell you what happened. We were shopping in the States, Michigan. George, you know Detroit.
I do, well.
Around that area there. And we go in to go, you know, take a break, get something to eat. Well, we walk into this restaurant. I immediately see two men sitting with maybe four or five girls around them, you know, and they're talking. And I give a kind of quick thought. I go, oh, yeah, two girls trying to, you know, enhance, you know, some followers. Well, we go sit down, and my husband excuses himself to go, you know, to the washroom. And I'm sitting there, and from my peripheral, you know, view, I can see them, but I'm not looking at them. But I start to feel this enhancement, you know, vibrations coming at me. And I'm going, okay. And because I'm on a journey, spiritual journey, I was aware that it was them sending with their mind, you know, telepathic thoughts, which is electrical, towards me. And I wouldn't budge. I just kept, you know, drinking my drink and just kept looking at ahead, and it kept getting heavier, and I still wouldn't budge. I'm smirking inside thinking, yeah, right, you idiots, you know, it's not going to work. And when my husband came back, it stopped. Well, later I didn't realize that it was Jim Jones and his associate, and I did research.
And
they were in that area, and you know, the Detroit area, and one of their speaking engagements, and it was him. And I thought, ah, oh, that's how, you know, which is typical for, you know, like you said, everything you said about the cult, how they use it. And had I not had the knowledge, the spiritual knowledge and awareness, I would have said, oh, you know, these gentlemen, how, you know, charmers, you know, thinking everything's all right. No, deadly. And I hope, Peter, that your book is an enlightenment to people, that you can't just look at them. You have to know the spirit that they come in and do your research, and I hope people put more out there to enlighten us.
I appreciate it.
There you go. Thanks, Linda. Appreciate it. Great story. Great story indeed. With the time remaining, let's go to Kevin in Titusville, Florida to get him on. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, George and Peter. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
You too.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to very quickly... I am 58. My brother's, I think he's 62. We used to live together in the late 70s. We partied, you know, the pot smoking and the drinking and all this stuff. But there was a time where I was actually allowed to go to this thing called, okay, he has followed since this time in about 77, 78, a guy named Guru Maharaji. The people who are like, let's say, disciples in the Christian church, they call them premies. I actually was somehow invited. He invited me to go to this sort of introductory, let's, you know, see how this thing is, first-timers meeting, and it really scared me. I always wondered if he was involved with, he was sucked into it because he's still involved in it with drugs or whatever. I'm actually Catholic. He was brought up Catholic. And I just say that because every time I bring up, let's say, Graham, our dear grandmother who's long passed, She always said, God bless you, at the end of her conversation. I'll say that to him, and he just doesn't even want to hear it. Now, he meditates. No, he's not into violence. It's nothing like ISIS or, well, you know, any of this kind of stuff. But there's all sorts of, there's a broad spectrum of cult, in quote, or occult or whatever. But I'm wondering if you can touch on this situation, which kind of bothers me, because he seems out there, although he might seem kind of happy. I can't talk to him on a certain level, but in the nine siblings in my family, I'm the only one who is close to him in that way, if you understand. I had a little sampling, and I even talked to him. I understand that one of the things they believe Jesus Christ was the perfect master, and this guy, Guru Maharaji, today is the perfect master. And one last thing, my brother one time, they'll go across the world. He went to Reykjavik, Iceland, my brother did, when he hardly had any money, spent all his money to see this guy. And he goes all over the world, and the guy lives in a mansion, has a wonderful lifestyle, but he kind of bleeds off people in this way.
And some of them do that. Peter, the clock is going to get us, but these cult followers and cult leaders all have a similar pattern to them, don't they?
Well, they do. They need the followers like they need fuel. And if you're a really spiritually advanced person, you don't need followers. You don't need to groom all these other people around you.
They will come. Peter, thank you for being on the program. Have a great new year. I'm sure we'll be talking to you in 2017. Up next, those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines.